This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Syria in crisis. The coronavirus may be grabbing worldwide headlines. Nonetheless, other global crises demand our attention. What began as a peaceful civilian uprising 9 years ago against the brutal regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has evolved into one of the most horrific humanitarian and political disasters in the region, if not the globe. At least 400,000 people have died since the uprising began. The conflict has displaced more than half of Syria's people and created the largest refugee population in the world. In recent weeks, the Syrian civil war entered a new phase when, in late February, Bashar al-Assad's regime began an assault on the northwestern Idlib province, a region that had remained outside of its control since the early years of the conflict and is considered the last rebel stronghold in the country. According to the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies in Washington, the regime's military operations have displaced close to 1 million Syrian refugees who fled to the Turkish-Syrian border in recent weeks. The Russian Air Force and Iran-backed militias have aided Syrian regime forces who attacked Idlib, inevitably exposing the civilian population as well as Turkish troops to danger. Seeking to avenge the killing of at least 34 Turkish soldiers, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan bombarded Syrian regime targets in Idlib. The situation remains tense, despite a fragile ceasefire between Ankara and Moscow. Syrian refugees, among whom are many women and children, fleeing the violence in Idlib, have borne the brunt of the geopolitical machinations among Syria, Russia, Iran, and Turkey. Well, joining us to analyze the complicated political and humanitarian landscape in Syria are two regional experts. Mona Yacoubian is senior advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where her work centers on conflict analysis and prevention with a specific focus on Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. And Hussein Ibish. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Mona Yacoubian, let me begin with you. And let's start by looking at the state of play, by actually looking backward 9 years since this uprising and the subsequent civil and proxy war began. Did you ever imagine that it would come to this current tragic and terrifying juncture? And then what are some of the main factors, in your view, that have contributed to this current geopolitical and humanitarian state of play?
Well, I think it at that time was unimaginable that we could see what started again as peaceful protests, teenage boys scrawling graffiti on the walls, that it would turn into exactly what you've described, this multi-level complex conflict. And I think this is largely a result of the fact that we have seen multiple actors getting involved in this conflict. It started again as a peaceful uprising. It rather quickly became a civil war. But then beyond that, as regional players and even other international players began to become involved in the conflict, it quickly morphed into what we're seeing today.
So let me get your take, Hussein Ibish. Could you have imagined the state of play today? And what do you think are some of the main factors that contributed, whether inaction or action?
I could have, in fact, yeah. I think if you viewed Syria through the lens of the Lebanese experience, and I think there are a lot of similarities between the countries, not just cultural, it is imaginable that you'd end up in this situation. I think that there are several key turning points that I'd point to for how we went from these peaceful protests in a couple of cities, in Daraa and Deir ez-Zor and a few other places in the periphery of Syria, you know, to this situation we have now. I think the first key thing was the decision of the regime, which is not surprising, to use every means possible to ensure that the peaceful protests became an armed uprising, to give people no choice by using brute force themselves. By themselves militarizing the situation, they sort of forced people who wanted to continue to fight against the regime to pick up arms. And from the beginning, they talked about a war against terrorism and an invasion of Syria by terrorists and regional forces and Al-Qaeda. And they kind of imagined ISIS before ISIS existed, and then they willed it into existence. And they got their way. So that's one crucial thing. Now, once we have the war, I think the next crucial phase is the swinging away from rebel momentum towards the regime, right? And that's two phases. That's the extraordinary disinclination of the United States to get involved under President Obama, which was remarkable, and the intervention in the fall of 2005, joint surge in intervention by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah.
2015, you mean?
In 2015. In the summer of 2015, Iranians, including the late Qasem Soleimani, went to Moscow and presented maps and a scenario and basically told the Russians, look, our mutual ally, Assad, is going to fall if we don't intervene. And so they came up with a joint plan, Russian, Hezbollah, and other militias on the ground, intervening with Russian air support and diplomatic cover and intelligence. And they did it. And it swung the momentum. And so Assad survived. So the other surprising thing is that Assad has not been overthrown. Once the war was effectively won in most of the country by Assad, and the last gasp there was the fall of Aleppo in 2016. Once that happened, I think the subsequent fall of these deconfliction zones, which were basically rebel strongholds, of which Idlib is the last one, was kind of predictable. And at that point, I think this tragic situation kind of was foreseeable. The surprising thing really is that Assad won the war. And that's sort of the biggest shock, I think.
Exactly. The bloodthirsty Bashar al-Assad not only remains in power, but has been emboldened by outside forces, by Russia, by Iran and its proxy militias, and also, of course, the inaction of the United States, the reluctance to help the civilian and rebel forces. But let's go to today, Mona Yaqubian, the Idlib situation. Mm-hmm. It's the last rebel stronghold. Discuss what happened there. Why do you think the Syrian regime felt so emboldened to attack? And what about Turkey's role?
Well, again, I think this is part of a plan that the regime has had. Hussein rightly points out it really started with Russia's intervention in the fall of 2015. That then facilitated the move on Aleppo, which fell in 2016. And we are seeing essentially the culmination of this strategy by the regime to claw back territory. And so in many ways, the current offensive is not unsurprising. There was a de-escalation agreement that was negotiated between the Russians and the Turks in the fall of 2017 that quieted things for some period of time. But the regime, and frankly Russia behind it, has made it clear that it is essential that they retake Idlib, because Idlib is very strategically located. It is a buffer to Latakia, which is really the Alawite stronghold. That's the minority sect from which the president comes. It also is an area through which a key strategic highway runs. This is the M5 highway, which is essentially sort of the I-95 of Syria, right, if you will.
I-95 being a major transnational highway here in the United States.
Exactly. And so in order for Assad to really consolidate his hold on power, it is essential that he regain control of, if not the entire government, a large portion of it. And that is what we're seeing happen today. The current offensive really dates back to April of last year, but then we've seen, beginning in December, a real increase in the level of hostilities. So much so that beginning in February of this year, we've seen massive displacement, the largest single episode of displacement in the 9-year conflict to date. So nearly a million civilians forced to be on the run from a very brutal offensive.
I do want to talk about that. But first, let me get back to Hussein Ibish for your take on the importance of Idlib. And where do we stand right now? And what about the Turkish-Russian agreement and their relationship? Is Russia a broker on behalf of both parties, that is Syria and Turkey, or are they basically doing Bashar al-Assad's bidding? How do you see that?
Russia is the primary patron and defender of Assad. And Russia is using this conflict not only to advance their interests and their presence and to bolster their client, Assad, they're also using it to assert their domination over Syria as the main outside power. Since the fall of Aleppo, there's been a competition between Iran and Hezbollah on the one hand, and Russia on the other hand, over who holds sway in Syria. Who's the main caller of shots other than Assad? Who's dependent on all these outside forces? Well, Russia is making it very clear. It's Moscow. It's not Tehran. They can help on the ground. They have a role. But it's really Russia that gets to decide. I think Mona is absolutely right about the strategic location of Idlib, which makes it so important to all the players. And it has different significance for different ones. For Assad, it's the two highways, right? There's the east-west highway, the M4, which is now going to be jointly patrolled. I'm sure we'll get into that. And the north-south one that Mona was referring to, which is the M5. And they actually intersect in Sarakiv, in this very kind of backwoods sort of town, which is strategically crucial because these highways intersect right next to it. And that is now in the hands of the regime. So what's happened is that the M4 is going to be shared, but the M5 in its crucial is now in the hands of the Russians and the Syrian army. The other thing is that for Turkey, it's the border area, a bit more to the north, that's crucial to them. The Turkish interest is to, first of all, make sure that there is not a strong Kurdish paramilitary presence in northern Syria along the southern Turkish border, and that's been certainly since the fall of Aleppo, and even before that. The main interest of Turkey went away from getting rid of Assad towards blocking a major Kurdish presence there. The other thing is keeping Syrian refugees out of Turkey because there is this sort of concentric circles of fear of Syrians. And so you get, you know, the first circle is Turkey, and then beyond that, Greece and southern Europe, and then beyond that, the rest of Europe, and then the world. So in a certain sense, Turkey is acting as the front line for the entire West in keeping Syrians, ordinary Syrians, many of them children, lots of them also women. These are not fighters with guns. Just keeping Syrian people out.
Exactly. Yeah. But the problem is Bashar al-Assad sees anyone who opposes him, even innocent civilians, women and children, as somehow terrorists.
Oh, definitely. One of the most interesting things about this is that many of the people who have been displaced, who are now in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey and elsewhere, Assad does not want back in Syria. He does not really want these people to be repatriated. A lot of the people who have been displaced are people who he would prefer never to come back to Syria because he sees them as part of a natural opposition.
And they're mostly Sunni.
Yes, mostly.
They are, and they are also, I think, while Assad doesn't want them back, they are also quite fearful of returning so long as Assad is in power.
Right, and he is a part of the minority Alawite ethnic religious group, which is more Shia oriented. But before, the irony is this was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious mosaic of a country where Christians, the Alawites and Sunnis really lived very harmoniously, even Syrian Jews, and now it has devolved into this terrible sectarian conflict.
Absolutely. I think that Syria will never return. We've even seen parts of the country, as it's called, demographically re-engineered. There have been episodes of ethnic cleansing, not just Sunnis, but certainly Sunnis from large parts of the country, Kurds from certain areas. This is in part when Turkey made one of its incursions into northwestern Syria, a Kurdish-dominant area called Afrin. They were pushed out of that area. This is going to be a long-term, multi-generational challenge. The extent to which Syria's social fabric has been destroyed cannot be overestimated. And it will take generations to sew that country back together again, if it's even possible.
Yeah. And this is where the comparison with Lebanon becomes, you know, sort of unmistakable.
Yes.
What we've seen in a way is the Lebanization of Syria, but writ large and more brutally and more definitively. Yeah.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, back to when we were talking about how this all began, and Hussein, you saw it coming. Many of us didn't. And I think one of the things that we didn't quite appreciate was the extent to which for Assad, as a member of a minority sect, the stakes were existential. They were existential from day one. And he proved that he would stop at nothing.
That's
to
right.
To include using chemical weapons against his people.
Nothing to remain in power.
To remain in power. Because from his perspective, it was either he stays in power or he dies.
And his whole community dies. I mean, I'm sure he thinks, and much of his community thinks, there would be a mass expulsion or a genocide against them if they lost.
But I wonder if that would really have come to pass, Hussein. It seems to me that he almost, like you said, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy for him by virtue of the way he attacked violently
the
opposition.
Right. At the beginning, I don't think this was driven by anti-Alawite animus.
No.
But over time, resentment against the regime and the criminal gangs surrounding it and then the broader Alawite community has grown. And now I think various minority communities, not just Alawites, also many Syrian Christians and others, are really fearful of what an opposition victory might look like because, A, the way extremists have come to dominate the opposition, especially Islamist extremists of various stripes, and again, that's something Assad and Iran and Russia have worked very hard to make sure happened.
Absolutely.
And they insisted on it, and it happened. And then the second thing is the general resentment that they fear correctly is often aimed indiscriminately at them. The well is poisoned between different kinds of Syrians in a way that's like Lebanon on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I still maintain it didn't have to be that way.
It
but nonetheless,
didn't have to be
all
that
right.
way.
We're going to take a quick break before we conclude the program. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Mona Yacoubian. She's the senior advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Hussein Ibish. He's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And we're examining the current political and humanitarian crisis in Syria. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, David Schneider from Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion. Back to you, Mona Yacoubian, to talk about the humanitarian crisis. We're seeing the Syrian refugees, over a million, as you said, among whom are so many innocents, women, children. Are they still being blocked at the border with Turkey? We know that Turkey was threatening not to let them in, to turn them toward Europe, which could violate this agreement between Europe and Turkey, using that as leverage. Help us understand the current situation.
Yeah. Well, you're touching on perhaps one of the most significant dimensions of this conflict. A million people, just since December 1st, forced out of their homes. They are not refugees, but they are internally displaced, or they're called IDPs. Syria has the largest number of IDPs in the world, 6.2 million people. There are another 5.6 million refugees who have been forced to leave Syria and seek safe haven, whether it's in Turkey, which hosts the largest number of refugees, or Lebanon, which has the largest number of refugees per capita in the world. And this displacement crisis poses a generational challenge because, as we were talking earlier, people are fearful to return to Syria. And so it could be we're talking a generation or more of these refugees living in host countries. But the host countries themselves, of course, are growing increasingly impatient with hosting so many refugees in their midst. And it's important to note they're not in camps. They live in and amongst the host community. I think this is a key factor, actually, for President Erdogan in Turkey and why it is that he has been so bound and determined to not allow any more refugees to come into Turkey from Idlib because of the large number of refugees that they host and the political and domestic tensions that that's now causing in Turkey. If you turn to Lebanon, Lebanon is on the verge of a financial meltdown, an enormous crisis. They also have a lot of coronavirus in Lebanon. And so how is this little country going to be able to contend with so many refugees? At the same time, I think the international community is very concerned that as tensions in these communities grow, whether in Lebanon or in Turkey, there will be a move to try and forcibly return Syrian refugees back into Syria. And that also would be disastrous.
I think one of the Turkish ideas has been to create what they call a safe zone in northern Syria, which would basically eventually become a kind of gigantic concentration camp for refugees that cannot be repatriated into the rest of Syria, but are not allowed out of Syria. And it would really be a kind of incredible nightmare. The Turks are being driven by two factors. One is this refugee issue, which is a really serious political and economic concern. The other is the exposure of Turkish troops. 34 were killed by a Russian bunker buster bomb recently. And that's what led up to the ceasefire that's in place now, not the new one, but the one that's existed for a couple of weeks. And basically, because there are thousands of Turkish troops in northern Syria and Russia controls the airspace, they are incredibly vulnerable and exposed. Moreover, there are 12 Turkish posts all over Idlib and other parts of Syria that are completely surrounded by government-controlled and allied forces. They were put there because of the de-escalation agreement 3 years ago that we were talking about, but now they're absolutely exposed. So the Turkish troops are extremely vulnerable, and that's the other big concern. And that's why Turkey made so many concessions in the recent agreement with Russia. They really made huge concessions, and it's because they're overextended and they're exposed.
But I think also Europe is implicated in this.
No doubt.
Because as we might recall, in 2015, there was a massive influx of refugees into Europe, about 1 million refugees. There are a lot of people that connect that to the rise of xenophobia in Europe.
Correct.
Some people even connect it to Brexit. And what we've seen now is President Erdogan turning toward Europe and saying, hey, if you don't shoulder more of the burden here, I'm going to open the gates. And in fact, he did open the border between Turkey and Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there are a number of refugees caught in essentially no man's land. They've been fired upon, etc. The Europeans are terrified because they can't handle politically, I think, the influx of more refugees.
They don't want to handle it.
Ordinary Europeans are opposed to it.
They could handle
fair
it,
enough.
But they do not care to handle it.
That's a very fair point. I would agree with that. But I think what we're seeing, though, is an inability for the Europeans and Erdogan to come to some sort of agreement. So President Erdogan was in Brussels earlier last week, and there is a future meeting planned between Erdogan, President Macron of France, Chancellor Merkel of Germany, and possibly even Boris Johnson from Britain, to try and see if they can sort through more this issue. Is it more financial assistance that the Europeans can provide to Turkey? And at the same time, the Europeans want more ironclad guarantees that Erdogan won't weaponize, if you will, the refugees and send them again towards Europe.
I think the sickest thing in this entire scenario, other than killing people, is the, I think weaponization is a good word, the instrumentalization of millions of ordinary people. The proportion of women and children among them is very high, especially children. At least 1 million of the 3 million people are under the age of 18. And almost all the parties have weaponized these people. Mm-hmm. The Syrian government has, the Turks have, the Europeans have in their own way, the Russians have, the Iranians have. It's one of the most gruesome examples of ordinary human beings being used as pawns in a cynical chess game that I've seen in a long time.
And we have very little time left, so back to you, Mona Yacoubian. What about the U.S. role? Is there one in addition to that of Europe? Because this crisis, whether humanitarian or political, is having ramifications and will have more serious implications. We're going to have more extremism resulting from these pockets of refugees who, through no fault of their own, are having to flee. We're just looking at a ticking time bomb as well.
Absolutely. And I think that what's happened in Syria is a reflection of the lack of U.S. leadership on these issues, whether it's on the issue of displacement and refugees, on the issue of human rights and the transgression of those rights. And I think in many ways, it is critical for the United States to step up and take a position of leadership on what's happening in Syria. We need to sort of take a stand in the international community to protect these civilians, women and children, who will be met with quite an onslaught.
Well, you get the last word, Hussein, because it doesn't look too likely under the current administration.
It's not, yes, I think it's something perhaps for the next administration to look at.
Well, on that rather pessimistic note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Mona Yacoubian, Senior Advisor to the Vice President of Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and Hussein Ibish, Senior Resident Scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Encounter was produced in Washington, and thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.